A listener told me a funny story the other day. He had bought one of those fancy new exercise bikes, and for him, it was without a doubt a very special tool to help him get healthier. But the problem was 3 days went by, and then four, and he'd yet to use the bike. And then on night five, he's sitting at the kitchen table, and he looks down at himself, and he couldn't help but just laugh. Because there he was, wearing the exercise t-shirt that came with the bike, and he was eating two corn dogs. Hi, it's Doug Hastings with Moody Radio, and I think we'd all agree having a special tool only matters if we use it to our benefit. And I'd love for you guys to learn about my friends at United Faith Mortgage, a very unique faith-focused mortgage team with an advantageous tool just for you. You see, United Faith Mortgage is an arm of a bigger company who is a direct lender, which means they get to use their own money and make their own decisions. There's no middleman, and often this advantage allows them to get you a better rate on your refinance or your new home purchase, which can save you monthly and lifelong money. So I'd encourage you, check them out, United Faith Mortgage.
United Faith Mortgage is a DBA of United Mortgage Corp., 25 Melville Park Road, Melville, New York. Licensed mortgage banker. For all licensing information, go to nmlsconsumeraccess.org. Corporate NMLS number 1330. Equal housing lender. Not licensed in Alaska, Hawaii, Georgia, Massachusetts, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Utah.
As the economy continues to recover, employers in many sectors are scrambling to find workers and to hang on to the ones they have. Does that mean it's time to ask for a raise? Hi, I'm Rob West. Several factors indicate employers should be more receptive to increasing wages, but how you ask for a raise can really improve your chances of getting one. I'll talk about that first today, then it's on to your calls at 800-525-7000. That's 800-525-7000. This is MoneyWise Live, where biblical truth guides our financial decisions. Okay, so too often people aren't prepared to ask for a raise, and they end up saying things that convince the boss not to give them one. Here are a few examples of things never to say. Never say, "I've been here 5 years and I've never once asked for a raise before." Never say, "I show up on time," or "I didn't quite achieve the goals you set for me, but I really worked hard." "I'm underpaid. I want 200 more a week." "Bob's been here a year and he got a raise." Or never say, "I'm buying a house and need the money." Notice that all of those statements are about you, not the company and how it benefits from your work. So before you bring up the subject of money, you need to prepare a foundation. Work up a list of goals that will help your employer. The first, obviously, is to do great work in your current position. Have an informal conversation with your boss. Mention that you have goals and that you'd like to advance in the company. Get suggestions on how you can do your job better to prepare for a larger role without talking about money. Next, let it be known that you're willing to take on more responsibility, and by all means, follow through if it's given to you. Think about what the company is trying to achieve and what's needed to do that. Identify obstacles and start trying to solve them on your own, if possible. If you're not in a position to do that, at least offer suggestions, all the while doing above par in your current job. But you're still not ready to talk about money. You still have some homework to do. Make a list of your accomplishments with the company so you have something to talk about. What problems have you solved that streamline the operation? Have you done something to get or retain customers, reduced overhead, or increased the bottom line? Some of these things your boss may not even be aware of, so start making a list. Also, note any new responsibilities you've taken on, especially if they weren't a part of your original job description. Those items will be especially useful when you have the money conversation. Your next bit of homework is research. Find out what others in your geographic area with similar job titles and duties are earning. You can do that online at PayScale, Glassdoor, and Salary.com. Those sites can give you the data you need to ask for a precise number, which makes you look informed. Now, armed with all of that information, you're ready to do a dry run with your spouse or a friend acting as your boss. Ask the person to be a bit skeptical so you're challenged to anticipate questions. Make note of those questions and then prepare answers, again, citing information you've already gathered about your performance and the pay scale of others doing similar work outside the company. Armed with the facts and some practice under your belt, you'll have confidence for the real conversation. So, now you're ready to meet with the boss in a more formal setting. When you meet, use the data you've collected to show why you deserve a raise. But it's important that you do so with humility. You don't want to sound arrogant. Just state the facts. Now, never talk about why you need more money. That's really not the boss's problem. The more you make it about the company and its goals, the more likely you are to succeed. But does all this mean that you'll get a raise? No, it means that you're more likely to get a boost in your paycheck. But of course, there are no guarantees, so you have to be prepared for a no. If that happens, it doesn't have to be the end of it. Ask for an interim evaluation period during which you have defined goals. Ask that the raise be conditional upon meeting those goals. That will show your boss that you're serious. Worst case scenario, you just can't convince your boss that you're worth more and you don't get the raise. But there's still a silver lining. With all the preparation you've done and data you've collected up to that point, you're now in an excellent position to land a new job somewhere else. And in today's economic climate, you may find that easier than you think. So there you have it. Everything you need to know about asking for a raise. Your calls and questions on any financial topic are next. Here's the number, 800-525-7000. That's 800-525-7000. You're listening to MoneyWise Live, where biblical truth guides today's financial decisions. We'll look forward to hearing from you, whether it's savings, debt, talking about your giving, whatever's on your mind. Give us a call. We'll look forward to hearing from you next. Thanks for joining us today on MoneyWise Live, where we apply God's truth to your financial decisions. 2,300 verses in Scripture dealing with money and possessions. So what's on God's heart as it relates to your money? Well, there are principles and passages that we can pull out of God's Word. And here's the thing. God's Word is always relevant. It's always right. It's never going to change. So no matter the tax code, no matter the economy or the interest rates, these principles are God's wisdom, and they always work. And so when we go to Scripture and apply that to every facet of our lives, including our money, I believe we put ourselves in a position to experience God's best. Now, that doesn't mean we're always going to have more than we need or we won't struggle. We will. And we hear from folks who have an abundance. We also hear from folks on this program every week who are really in a desperate financial situation. And wherever we're at, we need to recognize what it means to live with contentment, recognizing the abundance that we have that has nothing to do with money and begins with the fact that we have a Lord that will says that says, I will never leave you or forsake you. We start there, and it puts everything in perspective. But with the resources that pass through our hands, we want to be good stewards, good managers. Well, let's try to do that today. What are your questions? Here's the number. Lines are open, 800-525-7000. That's 800-525-7000. We'd love to hear from you today. We're going to talk in just a moment about financing a car. Should you borrow or should you pay in cash? But first, let's head to Georgia. Peggy, I understand you had your identity stolen. Is that right?
Yes, sir. You all are such a blessing. But I did. I had my purse stolen at an event. And within 30 minutes, we knew some of the damage that they had done. But it's been 2 years ago, and I'm still seeing the repercussions of that. And yes. The bank is like, you need to stay out of anything digital for a while, which is really hard. But sure. I've done that, and God has blessed me by tripling my salary. He is just so good, and I want to fix things, but I don't know how to go about doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Peggy, I'm so sorry to hear that. Unfortunately, it's all too common these days. Did they use your credit cards to make fraudulent purchases? Was it limited to that, or did they actually open new accounts in your name?
No, I actually didn't have any credit cards. Okay. But they took my debit cards, and they stole my license and a couple other ID cards I had, and they opened up accounts. They bought a car. They even got prescriptions. Yeah, that's some kind of prescription program. I mean, it was crazy, all the stuff they did, and sad.
So apart from just kind of cleaning up the damage that's been done, are there any ongoing issues as to whether or not somebody's still asking you to pay for something that they purchased fraudulently in your name, or has all that been taken care of?
No, sir, it hasn't been taken care of. Even like some of the companies were understanding of that because I had to file a police report, but the police decided like not to go down that day. And so some of them are like, you know what, that just sounds fake, and I'm still dealing with them, but it impacted my credit score so badly, and, you know, I don't know how to fix that.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you've already done a few things, clearly, but, you know, the steps are, I mean, the first thing you want to do, obviously, is notify the affected creditors and banks that your information has been compromised so they can close accounts, change account numbers, things like that. You immediately want to put a fraud alert on your credit report and freeze your credit. Have you done both of those things, the fraud alert and the freeze?
I did not freeze, but I did file a fraud alert, and I notified everybody by, I forget what it's called, but they had to sign for the letter.
Yes. Okay.
I'm sorry, it just started.
No problem. And we're losing you just a bit, but I think I heard your response. Clearly, you want to freeze your credit. That's something you could do at no cost based on legislation that was passed about a year and a half ago. So you'll contact each of the three bureaus, Peggy, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian. Tell them you want to freeze your credit. That's basically going to implement a PIN number, a four-digit PIN number that is going to prevent any new accounts from being opened, because simply a lender is not going to be able to access your credit file without that PIN number. So if somebody impersonates you and tries to open an account in your name, in order to do that, the lender that is looking to extend credit in your name to somebody that they think is you will not be able to access your credit report because that person that's doing this fraudulently won't have the PIN number. So that's really a key part. You're going to want to continue to check your credit reports at least monthly just to monitor them. I'm glad you filed the police report. That's critical. You also want to report the identity theft to the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. And then I think the next step is really to try to work with these lenders that extended credit, in particular the, you know, the car and any other ones, to make sure that they have a copy of the credit report. I mean, excuse me, the police report, so that they know that this was not you, and that that can be cleared up, so that they can pursue whatever means they have to make themselves whole, but they're not holding you liable for this. Once that's been done, you can then begin to remove the fraudulent information from your credit report by working with the credit bureaus so that they know these were not your accounts, providing that police report when they can't verify that it's yours, or when they get proof that it's not yours, they need to delete that information. Of course, you need to change all your passwords regularly, replace stolen IDs, including your Social Security card. It's not a fun process by any means. You may also want to look at one of the services like LifeLock or one of the others. I don't tend to recommend those unless you've been through something like you have, because a lot of this, you know, until something like this happens, it's just an unnecessary added expense. But in your case, you want somebody who's, you know, monitoring this actively for you and providing some insurance to make you whole in the event something like this happened again. So I think those are really your next steps. Just stay on this diligently until all the lenders acknowledge they're not yours, until the credit reports clean them up. Place that freeze on there immediately, and then just use good practices when you are doing business online. And as you said, you may want to take a break from that for a while. So I'd love for you to check in with us, Peggy, along the way as you let us know how this turns out. And I'm so sorry to hear what you're dealing with, but we appreciate your call today very much. Before we head to Idaho and talk to Lauren, let me remind you, we do have some lines open today. We'd love to hear from you, whatever's on your mind financially. We'd love to chat about it. Here's the number, 800-525-7000. That's 800-525-7000. We've got about, more than five lines open right now. To Meridian, Idaho. Lauren, thank you for your patience. How can we help you?
Hi, I just wanted to know, do I finance a car or pay cash for it?
It is always better, Lauren, to pay cash rather than finance. Now, I realize that may strap you financially, and I certainly don't want you to be in that position. I don't want you to use your emergency fund. So if you need to borrow, as long as you fit into the budget because you don't have the funds available, then, you know, that would be the only reason to do it. But if you have the ability to pay, clearly, you know, that's going to be the best option. I mean, if you finance a $20,000 car, you put $4,000 down, you have an interest rate of, 4.5%, the loan's for 36 months, you have roughly a $500 payment. At the end of that 36-month term, you'll have paid more than $1,000 in interest. So, I mean, there's a real cost there that I'd love for you to avoid, again, as long as you don't put yourself in a difficult spot in terms of, eating up all of the liquid savings that you have. Ideally, the goal would be, if you have to borrow for this next car, then once it's paid off, I would continue making that payment to yourself, perhaps in a separate savings account that's earmarked for car purchases, so that you have the ability to pay cash for the next one. Does all that make sense, though?
Absolutely. We've been doing the Dave Ramsey thing for a while, and we've got almost 6 months of income saved up.
Great.
And he says 3 to 6. So I'm like, well, should I just pay cash? And
yeah. So I think in that case, I mean, as long as nobody knows the future except the Lord, so we don't know what's coming. But if you have pretty predictable income and some stability there, you're not in one of the sectors of the economy that's been impacted, by the pandemic, then I would say I'd be comfortable with you going down to the 3 month mark. If that meant that you could pay cash for the car or put a significant down payment such that you could then build that back up, especially if you have money each month that you would have been sending to the car payment that you can use to rebuild your savings. I just probably wouldn't go much lower than 3 months. We appreciate your call. I hope that's helpful today. Phone lines are open, 800-525-7000. This is MoneyWise Live. Stay with us. We're grateful you've decided to tune in to MoneyWise Live today, where God's truth is applied to your financial questions and decisions. Phone lines are open, 800-525-7000. We started today by talking about how to ask for a raise. We're in a really interesting environment right now from a work standpoint. As the economy opens up, it just seems like folks are really struggling to hire. This is an opportunity to, if you're adding value to the company and in a position to do so, to ask for a raise. But that always brings us back to the purpose of work. And keep in mind, work was ordained before the fall. We were created to be productive, to be workers. Adam and Eve had a job to tend to the garden and to name the animals. And, as we think about that, we realize God is the creator, and then we take his creation and improve it. And we're to be productive throughout the whole of our lives. And, as we think about the idea behind work and working for an audience of one, the Lord himself, we need to impart that to our kids also. Instilling this idea of hard work is so critical. And I really believe children need to experience the benefits of working early in life. In other words, they experience the intrinsic value of working and feeling good about a job well done. And that provides the motivation to work, which is a self-perpetuating process. But they also need to experience the satisfaction of obedience. And so they shouldn't be paid for every job they do around the house. But work has a benefit in and of itself, and that's above and beyond the economic benefit of working. Although I do think we should pay them for certain chores that go beyond perhaps what they're expected to do as a part of the family, so they can experience the economic benefit that comes of working. This benefit comes from learning that money will provide something they really desire. And we also need to recognize that, kids can be motivated to work beyond the intrinsic value and the satisfaction of obedience and the economic rewards, because perhaps they get to do some of those things alongside mom and dad, which is fun in and of itself. So think about how you can instill that principle of hard work, which is so critical and very biblical, into your kids in a very practical way as you have conversations and you model that, but also you think about practical experiences you can create where perhaps they can work and do jobs beyond the expected, where they can see themselves do a job well done and then be rewarded for it economically. Let us know how that turns out. All right, back to the phones today. To West Palm Beach, Florida. Cecilia, thank you for your patience. How can I help you?
Yes, I heard you advising a young lady who got her credit in fraud. Should I go ahead and get a PIN number, even though I haven't had the problem of fraud on my credit card?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you absolutely can, Cecilia. It's really up to you. Here's the thing. The only downside, if you will, to that, because there's no cost and it's just providing added safety and security for you, is that it perhaps will be a slight hassle for you if you're out seeking credit. So if you went to buy a car and you needed to borrow to do that, or you wanted to open a new credit card, it's going to add an added layer of you providing that PIN number to, quote, unfreeze your credit temporarily for the lender to pull your credit report. I think that's a pretty good trade-off for the opportunity for you to have the accounts locked, so that in the event somebody compromised your information without your knowledge, they would be unable to, or it would be at least much more difficult to open an account fraudulently in your name. So as long as you're willing to go through that extra step of providing that PIN number, and by the way, if you're not out seeking credit, it doesn't really matter, then I would say absolutely go for it. Contact each of the three bureaus, let them know you want to freeze your credit report, and you can get that done quickly and free. So does that make sense?
Thank you so much. I never knew of this idea before. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. God bless you. Thanks for your call today. To Ohio, WCRF. Sammy, thanks for your patience. How can I help you?
Hey, I was calling because I just finished lunch with a young lady that I am thinking about proposing to, but she is very concerned about money-wise. I just finished school, and I was wondering how much should I put aside once I start my new job that I have lined up to buy a house, to put money towards the goals we've planned together and to pay for a wedding, because they're not cheap.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, it's great, Sammy, that you're thinking about this. And, you know, it's a really wise thing for you. If you get to that point where you all become engaged as a part of your premarital process, and I'd really encourage you to get some biblical premarital counseling, that you begin to talk about money, how it was handled growing up, how you want to handle it as a married couple, what your vision is for how you can use money as a tool to accomplish God's purposes. That's critical for you all getting on the same page. But really, you do the same thing you'd do for anything else, whether you're getting married or not. You want to make sure you have 3 to 6 months in an emergency fund. If you're planning to pay for a wedding, you need to develop a budget and figure out how you're going to get there without borrowing, and then just live well within your means. I want to send you a book that'll help with all of this called Money and Marriage God's Way. So you stay on the line and we'll get that right out to you. But all the best in your endeavors. May the Lord bless this potential upcoming wedding. We'll be right back with MoneyWise Live. Stay with us. Welcome back to MoneyWise Live. I'm Rob West. So glad to have you along with us today. Phone lines are open, 800-525-7000. You know, we get lots of calls from folks that are considering marriage, or perhaps they're engaged, wanting to know, how do we have a God-honoring marriage in this area of finances? What should we do? What do we need to know? And you know what I think is so critical is that, as I've said previously, you know, as you're going through that premarital counseling process, which you absolutely should, it's really critical that you have a lot of discussion that's open and honest about finances, especially if you're a little bit older. How have you handled money? Being real transparent about where each of you are at financially, what debt you're bringing into the marriage. age? You know, what savings? How have you handled money previously? Has it been an area of challenge for you? You know, really getting that on the table, but also talking about what lifestyle you feel like God has called you to and how money was handled growing up. What about giving goals and your view on giving? Who's going to be the bookkeeper? Because even though you're combining finances and two have to become one, I would say even with a single account, not having separate accounts, you need to have the person that's most aligned with the details to be the bookkeeper. That conversation is really critical. Then you need to have a plan that says, okay, based on combining our finances, where are we going from here in terms of what we want to try to accomplish? If money is a tool to accomplish God's purposes, what is our vision for what he's doing in our new marriage moving forward, and how can money support that? I also think it's critical that you have a mentor couple, a couple that's perhaps older, maybe from your church, that can walk alongside you specifically in this area of financial assistance, perhaps for the first year. I'm more concerned about the talk and the plan and the mentor couple than I am that you're ready financially. Because if you wait until you're financially, quote unquote, secure to get married, you might never get married. So the plan and the talk and having somebody to walk along with you is far more important to me than you having all the boxes checked financially before you proceed. So hopefully that's an encouragement to you today. And I really would recommend Howard Dayton's book, Money and Marriage, God's Way, as you think about a God-honoring marriage financially. All right, let's go back to the phones. John's been very patient, calling from Chicago, Illinois. John, how can I help you?
Yes, I have a question about removing hard inquiries off of Equifax. Since 2017, my identity has been stolen 3 times, and I've had companies run hard inquiries. Now, luckily enough, thanks to God, I haven't lost any money concerning this since 2017, but the problem I have is with Equifax. Equifax refuses to remove those hard inquiries. I've sent them police reports. I filed the paperwork that Equifax asked. I even went to those bogus government agencies, the Consumer Financial Bureau, FTC, Attorney General. I did all that, and none of them can seem to get Equifax to remove those hard inquiries. Now, TransUnion and Experian, they remove them right away. It's Equifax. Now, I still have one hard inquiry on my Equifax report right now for when my identity was stolen last year. And, I mean, I guess except going to small claims court, and since I can't get these bogus government agencies to actually help me out, how can I get Equifax to remove those fake hard inquiries off of my credit report?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that question, John. I know this must be frustrating. Here's the good news is that a hard inquiry, and for the benefit of our listening audience, that just simply means an inquiry that was performed on your credit report by a lender for the purpose of determining whether or not to extend you credit, or in John's case, extend credit to someone who was impersonating him, as opposed to a soft inquiry where you pull your own credit or try to look at your own credit file or get your credit score where you're the one initiating it. It's not for the purpose of determining whether or not to extend you credit. The good news is, John, that hard inquiry is very minor in terms of the impact on your overall credit score, especially as time passes. It's going to have the most impact right when it occurs, but then as time goes by, it's going to have very little impact on your credit score, number one. Number two, you can dispute errors with any new information you can provide the Bureau. If you make repeated claims with the same info, they'll dismiss it. But the problem might be with the creditor or debt collector providing the information to the Bureau where the hard inquiry was made. So I'd take the dispute to the creditor that submitted the information. And if that company provides information clearing your record, then share that with the credit bureau if you haven't already. If they won't provide you with what you need, I'd start writing emails to the company officials, perhaps even all the way up to the CEO, maybe using LinkedIn. That can be a very effective tool. Here's the thing. Under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, if they can't verify something is accurate, which if you can get proof that it isn't based on this this identity theft, under the FCRA, they have to remove it. by law. Now, your remedy is to sue the bureau or the creditor for failing to resolve the fraudulent issue. I don't think this is doing enough net damage to you by any means for you to take it to that level. If you wanted to do something, you could have an attorney write a letter, you know, to the offending party. Sometimes that can get the job done. But the bottom line is, John, I think this is, at the end of the day, having very little impact on you. I know it's frustrating, and so I'd stay at it, but even if you can't get it removed, I don't think it's really going to prevent you from getting the best terms and rates, because I don't think you're seeing much of a decline in your credit score. And we appreciate your call today. Let's head to Indiana. Rico, we appreciate your patience today. How can I help you?
Good afternoon. How are you?
Great, thanks.
My quick question is this. My emergency money is in a credit union. I'm just a little bit curious. It would be, one be best put it in a regular bank or a CD or instead of a credit union?
Yeah, and so you're talking about your savings account, or what type of money is this?
This is emergency money, the 3 months.
Yes. Okay, very good. Yeah, your emergency fund. I would actually prefer, I mean, there's nothing wrong with a credit union. That's great. You're just going to get a little better rate, perhaps, not always. Credit unions typically have very good rates, but you may have the ability to get a better rate by going with one of the online banks. So I often recommend Marcus, Capital One 360, and Ally Bank. Right now, they're paying about 0.5% on their high-yield savings accounts. No fees. You can have as many accounts as you want. You can link them up electronically to your checking account if you have that at the credit union, so you can move money back and forth. They have great websites, great smartphone apps. And so, you know, that's just kind of my preferred choice. Another option you could be, you could go to bankrate.com and just look around to see, you know, what other institutions you may want to consider based on, again, no fees and the highest interest being paid on the balance. But apart from you getting a little bit more interest and assuming you're not paying any maintenance fees on that savings account, I'm completely fine with you leaving it there at the credit union unless you were looking for a little better situation. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good, Rico. We appreciate it. And I understand you listen in the app, which is great. I'm delighted to hear that you're listening to MoneyWise Live through the MoneyWise app. If you haven't downloaded the app yet, you can do that. Just head over to your app store, the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store. Search for MoneyWise Biblical Finance, and you can listen to broadcast archives. You can participate in our MoneyWise community, ask a question, get answers from a coach. You can check out our Discover tab with all the podcasts and articles and videos, and you can manage your spending plan using our digital envelope system. Download the MoneyWise app today. Just search for MoneyWise Biblical Finance. Stay with us. We'll be right back with much more. We're glad you're with us today for MoneyWise Live, where we apply God's truth to your financial life. Back to the phones, Chattanooga, Tennessee. Barry, how can we help you, sir?
Yes, I was wanting to try to go ahead and follow the advice and buy a car with cash. I do have saved up the money, and I'm finding out that this is not the the mode of a lot of dealers. They want to actually steer people into a deal that involves a loan, and that gives them, I understand, that gives them money, that chance to make money over and above the cost of the sale.
Yes.
I'd like to try to find out if there are some techniques about buying that car with the cash and not paying exorbitant fees, as in dock fees, etc.
Yes. Yeah, very good. Are you looking to buy a brand new car, Barry, or a used car?
Used.
Used. Okay, very good. It does seem counterintuitive, does it, that a dealer won't want to give you a better deal if you pay with cash. And the fact is just what you said. Dealers make money on each loan they arrange, so they'd much rather help you finance the car. Now, smart dealers know that you know, there's a benefit to them if their customers, their cash customers, are treated right. It means a quick sale. and a better review on Yelp or another crowdsourced review site. So I might check around for dealers in your area that are good with cash. A great website for that would be DealerRater.com, DealerRater.com, and there's any number of other sources. The way I typically buy a car, and I love buying cars just because I make it a project or game, if you will, to buy it for the least expensive car as I can possibly afford. By looking at and finding the make and model I want, then I go to work on the research using the internet as my friend. The last car Julie and I bought, I ended up jumping on an airplane and flying four states away to buy the car and drive it home because we found a phenomenal deal from a dealership that sells the most cars in that particular state. You can do that if you're willing to put in the time. So once you know what you want and what the right price is, then I just start working the internet. And I would talk to the internet salesperson. Those folks are typically, doing higher volume and, let them know right up front, listen, I'm paying with cash. And, as much as they may not love that, because, again, they're giving up some money, I think they're still, if you find the right dealer who's motivated to move cars, and they all are, especially at the end of the month, you're going to do better at the end of the month than you will, any other time. Then, just keep doing your homework and you'll find somebody that'll give you a good deal. But I applaud you, Barry. Don't let that discourage you from paying cash for this car. You've done the hard work to save it up. Now you continue to do your legwork until you find the right vehicle purchase for you. Unfortunately, used cars are at a premium right now. They are quite expensive, but as long as you spend the time, you'll find the one that works for you. And I appreciate your call today. Down south to Florida, Olga, thank you for holding. How can I help you?
Thank you. Thank you for your program. It's very helpful. My question is, I married this person for more than 10 years. And when we divorced, he gave me 2 years of alimony. And because the COVID-19, I lost my jobs. I went to in bankruptcy, and now I have a part-time job, and I have the money enough. But my question is, I had the right to have my ex-husband Social Security.
Yes, you do, as long as you're eligible, Olga. So basically, you're eligible to collect spousal benefits on your former husband's earnings as long as, and you already mentioned the first one, your marriage lasted at least 10 years. You said it did. You've not remarried. You're at least 62 years of age. And your ex-spouse is entitled to collect Social Security, retirement, or disability benefits. As long as you meet those requirements, then you are absolutely eligible. Also, keep in mind, your ex doesn't have to be collecting his retirement benefits yet for you to claim ex-spousal benefits. He may have chosen to wait. You can go ahead and begin collecting. If this is the case, though, the divorce does need to be at least 2 years old. There's no such requirement for the 2-year waiting period if your ex is already receiving benefits, only if he is not. So sounds like you need to set up a virtual visit with the Social Security Administration. Just go to ssa.gov to do that. We appreciate your call today. To Grand Rapids, Michigan, Jim, thank you for your call today. How can I help you, sir?
Yeah, hi. Hey, I just bought a new house up north about 100 miles away from where I'm living now. So I just sold my house here and bought $120,000 equity. I'm going to put that, I owe about $128,000 on the new house. My thought is, pay the credit cards off, pay the car off, put like maybe $70,000 on the new house, get that down. Work is willing to give me like a 3-day week, and my retirement could pay the new house off if I just took a new job up north and just kind of retired. So that's kind of my question is like, do I do an early retirement, work the 3 days and commute to 100 miles once a week, or retire and pay the house off and just get a new job and put a little in savings?
Yeah. So if I understand correctly, do you already have a mortgage on the $128,000 that you owe in the new home?
Yes.
So by paying down 70 of it, that wouldn't help your mortgage payment. You'd still have the same mortgage payment until it's paid off. Tell me about, so you really, it's going to come down to, do you take a job locally or do you take a job out of town? And, you know, locally you may work 5 days, out of town you're going to work three. Is that right?
Right. Well, okay. Well, it's true, but on in the new mortgage, you can do an annuity or an amortization, like up yes. to 6 months, where you can put, you know, the equity down and actually change your mortgage lower
yeah.
the payment.
Sure. So you're going to re-amortize the loan. I don't have a problem with any of these plans. I mean, clearly you're not living beyond your means. You've thought about what it takes to fund your lifestyle. You know, you're working toward becoming completely debt-free. The fact that you have credit cards makes me wonder, you know, are you going to have the discipline to live within your means? But I love the fact that in either of these cases, you're trying to get out of debt, including your home, as quickly as you can, which is going to get your lifestyle need, your monthly expenses down as low as possible. Those are all good things. I think, you know, how you decide to slice and dice that with vis-a-vis a job local, a job out of town, that's really a quality of life issue, Jim, in terms of the work that you're doing and whether or not you want to spend that much time in the car. But, taking this money, I think at the end of the day, I'd love for you to have 3 to 6 months expenses in a savings account. I'd love for you to have all your consumer debt paid off and then pay down as much as you can on the house with what's left, re-amortize the loan. And then you, at that point, you'll know exactly what it takes to fund your lifestyle every month. And you just need to solve for that with whatever job you take. And ultimately, that's going to be a decision I would just pray through and think through very carefully. So I hope that helps you, my friend. All the best in this exciting new chapter and season of life. And we appreciate your call. Our final call today is going to be in Pennsylvania. Sally, you've been very patient. Thank you for that. How can I help you? Hi, Sally. Go ahead. Sally in Pennsylvania, are you with us? All right. It looks like we don't have Sally. Let me read what I believe is her question from my producer. I have a 401k and a Roth IRA. I want to retire in 4 years. Are there other investments I should have? Am I on track for retirement? I can't tell you if you're on track or not because I don't know the amount, but here's what I can say. You can figure that out yourself. So as to whether or not you're on track, I would just look at, first of all, what is your retirement budget going to look like? When you get to that point in 4 years, Sally, go ahead and do a budget as if you were there today. And anything that's coming out of that budget, you know, because let's say you're not saving for retirement anymore, you're already in it. You know, is there insurance you were carrying that you no longer need? I mean, just look at all your expenses and determine what that retirement budget is and what the bottom line is you need each month to fund it. Then beyond that, I would look at, okay, what guaranteed income sources do you have? Or if you're going to be collecting Social Security, how much is that? And then figure out what the gap is between any known income sources and what it's going to take for you to fund your lifestyle on a monthly basis. Ideally, you'd have enough in that 401k and Roth IRA such that at a 4% withdrawal rate, which ideally, if it's managed right, you wouldn't ever touch the principal, that 4% a year would fill the gap between your known income sources and what your monthly need is. And if you have that, that's great. If not, then you may need to work a little bit longer or reduce your lifestyle, perhaps sell a home, downsize, find other ways to cut back. As to the investment strategy 4 years out from retirement, you should be getting more conservative. You know, if we use the old 100 minus your age, let's say you're 65, 100 minus 65, you would have 35% in stocks, maybe 65% in bonds. These days, folks are using a little bit more aggressive strategies, perhaps as much as 45% in stocks, 55% in bonds. That's up to you, but clearly you should be getting more conservative. But I don't want you to get out of stocks altogether because we need that growth component that's the engine that's going to keep this growing over the next, let's say, 20 years. If the Lord tarries and you have good health, this money needs to last a long, long time. Lastly, think about getting a certified Kingdom Advisor to weigh in on all of this. You can do that at moneywiselive.org. Just click Find a CKA. We appreciate your call, Sally. That's going to do it for us today. MoneyWise Live is a partnership between Moody Radio and MoneyWise Media. Let me say thank you to my team. Producing today, Deb Solomon. Engineering, Amy Rios. Providing research, Mr. Jim Henry. Our call screener today was the fabulous Gabby T. And Samuel Bowen sitting in today as well. Thanks to you for being here. Come back and join us tomorrow, will you? We'll look for you then. May God bless you. Bye-bye.